Brad, before we start this week, I wanted to talk really quickly about news that had me incredibly excited because it's a hugely popular book series in my family, and that is Raina Telgemeier got a 1 million book run order for her new book, Guts. Did you hear about this?
1 million. So that's amazing.
I don't know her more than passingly, but I am so proud of her. 1 million book run is like she is almost single-handedly raising the next generation of cartoon readers and cartoonists.
She is comics, I would say, like right now. Her and Dave Pickley.
Yeah.
And it's so funny. I don't know if you guys have ever met her before.
No.
I have, yeah. She's delightful.
She's just so nice. You wouldn't think that she's basically an entire industry on her own.
Yeah, she single-handedly is the Harry Potter of comics. And she's so sweet and kind and lovely and welcoming. And I am so excited for her success because, frankly, it's raising a really nice generation of cartoon readers, too, you know, in the way that, like, Charles Schulz raised a nice generation. I'm so glad that it's not some weird comic that I'm like, oh boy, I wish kids weren't reading that.
Well, that's what I was just thinking, is that what a warm thought it is to sit there and think of the generation that she's going to be ushering in, all of the young people right now that are reading her books, that are going to get really attracted to comics and this whole medium. And that's going to be their touchstone, is Raina's work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's kind of a nice thought, you know, to think what the future holds.
It's also nice just to see in the American market that a graphic novel is getting almost Japanese levels of production volume, you know?
Yeah.
Where really it's a generation coming up that has no problem, and a whole series of teachers that has no problem assigning a graphic novel to kids. And I think that's wonderful. I don't know. I just feel incredibly optimistic by that whole development. So I'm really proud of her and excited for her.
That's a great way to start the show.
Well, on that note, hello everybody and welcome to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Strip.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, you get the honors. Introduce that third melodious voice.
I am very excited to welcome to the show this week. We've been excited for this interview for a while now.
Yeah.
Ngozi Yukazu of Check Please, where are you coming from physically today? Where are you located?
I am physically located in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. One of my favorite cities in the world. Now, is that home for you now, or are you visiting?
It's home for me, and I'm originally from Houston, Texas, but Austin is just a little bit cooler, so...
factor of about 1,000, is it a little bit cooler? Yeah.
No offense, Dave.
What is the comic scene like in Houston? In Austin, I should say.
Oh, yeah, okay. I started groaning because there isn't a comic scene in Houston, but... In Austin, there's so many comics creators who live here, and it's such an artsy town as the live music capital of the world, and, you know, the city that has the motto of, like, keep itself weird. It's a natural place for artists to congregate. So Staple is the small convention, indie convention that happens every year.
Oh, right.
And that's so great. It's just... a lot of people show up, and so I'm always excited for it in September every year. Yeah.
The thing I always laugh about when I think of Austin is the people that they just want to go out for a quiet dinner, and Austin being the live music capital of the world, like, can we just not with the band? I just want one meal without a band.
Just once could I go someplace and not hear a band.
Exactly. It's so funny.
I just wanted a sandwich.
Yeah. No, it's funny. I was with my friend, Madeline Rupert, who I'm working on a comic with. I felt so cool. We were walking down Congress Street and I was just like, oh wow, I can't look, live music. Who would have guessed tonight there'd be live music in Austin? So boy, she was impressed.
You know, you can't do something like that. So I'm over in Philadelphia, and the closest I can come to that is when I'm walking down the sidewalk and I go, have you ever seen a rat that size?
Yeah, Philadelphia is on the up and up. Okay, so you brought up Philadelphia, so we have to talk. And my comic's about hockey, so we have to talk about the Flyers' newest mascot.
Gritty.
Oh, my God. What are your opinions on Gritty?
Man, I'm telling you, in terms of character design, I really want to know who approved that, because I really don't think it's everybody's been really hammering poor Gritty an awful lot. But I think a lot of it is deserved. I don't know what they were thinking with that character design.
He's quite scary, legitimately terrifying.
Dave, do you know who we're talking about?
Yeah, it's kind of like the Hamburglar, if the Hamburglar was on LSD kind of a thing.
Yeah, if the Hamburglar grew up next to a power plant, So you're the first Philadelphian that I've met that isn't pro Gritty. A lot of people are just like, yeah, we love him. He's ours.
No. You know what? I've been hoping that somebody would bring this up, because I've got thoughts on this. Yeah, I really wonder whether, you know how a lot of people, I don't know whether technically they're in the millennial zone, but it's very popular for, boy, am I going to show my age, for younger people to have big beards. Right? I see a lot of people walking around with these big beards. Yeah. I wonder if that wasn't an attempt to say, we're going to have the first mascot that also has a big bushy beard.
The first millennial mascot, I think, is what...
That's kind of what I'm thinking. If I ever catch Gritty, ordering a small batch brewery beer, I'll have the last fact I need.
Yeah, is that an avocado toast?
I feel like they just took extra beard from Dr. Teeth in the Electric Mayhem.
There
and
you
said, go. We're gonna make a character out of this.
Man.
But speaking of hockey, I wanna talk to Ngozi about Check Please, because it's a coming of age story, it's a coming out story. But as a Southern Californian, I wanted to ask you specifically about hockey, because for me, hockey is this great mystery of a sport that I kind of understand, but it's never really sparked with me. And I wanted to know how your journey with hockey came about.
Oh, are you a sports person in general, though? Are you guys sports people?
Yes. Growing up, I, as Brad points out every once in a while, I was a sports person when I was younger. But the love has faded for professional sports as more and more money scandals came out. But
It was money scandals for you. It wasn't okay.
Yeah, no, I still enjoy college sports because there's more love of the game and the camaraderie and the team playing. Whereas professional sports, it just feels like, I don't know, it's just a wash in money. I don't know.
Interesting. I could interview you on that. I think it's really fascinating. it's really fascinating. When, young people are into sports, I find it fascinating when young men are into sports and what makes them become disinterested in sports. But you're into comics. So there was clearly a shift.
I think I became the nerd that I was always meant to be, and just quiet and cloistered and stuck in a room drawing. Yeah.
Awesome.
That's what happened.
My path into getting into hockey, I've always been into sports. Always a kid, was always a kid on the playground. I didn't play organized sports until high school. And even then it was just one semester of basketball, which I stopped because, I was taking AP chemistry and I was getting below a certain grade, and I was just like, no, this is not worth it. I've always loved watching sports documentaries. There's just this inherent narrative in sports that is, for whatever reason, so fascinating. I can't explain why I spent my summers in high school watching ESPN's 30 for 30 docuseries Simmons started. And so when I was in college, I wrote a screenplay on a college hockey player who falls in love with his best friend, which is kind of the spiritual predecessor to Check Please.
The Ur story for that one. Yeah.
and the crazy thing with that was hockey to me was and still is a very exotic thing, because I'm from Houston, Texas, and I'm a Black woman, so it's not really the biggest part of my culture. And then I just did all this research, and the more I researched, the more I was just this is the weirdest thing that's actually happening right now. And yeah, and I just had to, I know now that whatever I consume, I output, So like I'm reading these books about naval historical fiction and I'm like, uh-oh, now I have to make a story about that. But with Czech plays.
It's so funny. Yeah. Brad and I were just talking about this morning about you have to follow whatever your passions are leading you to. That's good.
So that's how I got into hockey. Yep.
Well, and storytelling wise, sports are, I think I've read you speak of this before, but sports are particularly helpful in a narrative arc for character development and for a character's storyline. What to you are the sort of helpful and defining aspects of sports and storytelling that work well together?
Oh my gosh. Okay. This is like an entire area of interest for me because I think sports as a genre and storytelling is fascinating, but sports and comics is like so weird. And it's basically cousins to the superhero genre. I don't know. Like if you guys read, not just superhero comics, but sports manga, like the ones I've read are just like Haikyuu, which is a volleyball manga, and then Slam Dunk, the really popular basketball manga. It's kind of just like built-in storytelling because like what a lot of sports comics, it's actually really hard to, because there's not a lot of Western sports comics, but what a lot of sports manga do is just set up like an impossible task, like an impossible antagonist and a very small underdog protagonist. And you see them like overcome these incredible hardships over and over and over again. And that's storytelling. It's like, it's the hero's journey. Instead of putting on a cape, like in a superhero comic, it's putting on that jersey. You have this team that you ramble together. That's like finding the fellowship as they go onto the ring. It's like built in just storytelling. So I always thought that was very fertile ground for narrative.
And do you ever find it limiting? Because I agree with you in huge strokes. Do you ever find it limiting that you have to follow the arc of a season to the arc of a character? Or do you find that in 99% of the time, it's perfect for what you need it to do?
It's usually pretty perfect. But see, that's the thing about sports. Like, I remember I had a friend who was like, he just couldn't get sports. Like it was always like, well, you always know one team's going to win and one team's going to lose. And even every season, you know, one team has to win, but there's so much of a narrative that goes into every single game and every single season. So like for Czech Please, I actually got this question. I remember it was at TCAF. Someone asked me like, how do you make things interesting if you know that the character has to win or lose? It's what happens outside of the game that kind of informs that.
Right.
So it's almost like you have like a thesis question, like, okay, like, my main character Biddy has a lot of issues with his dad. So if his dad goes to a game, like, and watches him, what does winning say about Biddy's relationship with his dad? And what does losing say? So it's not just, oh, they lost or won. It's now we've answered a question.
Right. 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 What's interesting too visually is that so many comics in a moment of exposition or just, you know, laying pipe somehow, the story kind of, the visuals kind of stop. They kind of freeze. People are sitting on a tree log by a lake, or they're sitting on a bench, and what's interesting about sports comics is you can, at the same time you're laying out a great deal of exposition, you can also have incredibly exciting visuals happening panel to panel, which I'm sure is incredibly fun to balance the two out when you're writing.
I would say so.
Well, the neat thing there is what I'm noticing when I read Czech Please is that I know if I were to do a sports comic, I would get bogged down in the minutiae of the game, right?
Yes.
In other words, I would get bogged down into who has the puck, who they're shooting it to, who's blocking, what the goalie is. And the nice thing that I see here is that a lot of the story obviously is what happens off the ice.
Yep.
But when we are on the ice, you're focused on, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems as if you focus more on the broad strokes instead of getting bogged down into, you know, like I would end up doing a wide shot from above with the puck going left, right down the ice and totally screwing up the story.
No.
Whereas you, it seems like you're focused right in on these headline moments during the game. Am I saying that right?
No, you're saying that absolutely right. But I don't think there's anything wrong with either approach. One of my favorite sports manga is called Haikyuu, and it is literally, it's like you go through three volumes and these kids have only played one game, but you're there. You're like, oh my God, Hinata, I hope he gets this next spike. But I think for me, I've always decided, like, I want it isn't just about the game. It's about what goes, like, I want what happens off the ice to inform what happens on the ice. So I want to focus on the big play. So,
yes,
but you can go either way.
See, that's this. Well, see, here's the deal. This is the trouble I get myself into, because I do a superhero comic, and a lot of it, especially for my sons, they're like, Dad, nothing ever happens in your comic, because for me, it's not about like battling over the city. It's about what's happening in these with these people and their personal lives as being instructed as coming from that superhero genre. So when I see the way you handle Check Please, I kind of feel as if we probably come from the same psychological background in that. I would bet that you'd probably be similar in to say, nah, it's really not about what happens on the ice. That is central, but the real story is what's happening around the ice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, yeah. Exactly. It's like, I'm trying to think of like action, like in terms of action movies, like Die Hard is the perfect action movie, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe. you don't have to agree. Actually, I don't even know where I was going with that, because I was trying to think of like a spectacular action sequence is like meaningless without the meaning behind it, right? So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I guess the play when I've kind of considered this in the past, my touchstone there has been Alfred Hitchcock, who could give you a story about a murder and you never saw the murder, but yet it was terrifying. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And sometimes for me, storytelling isn't about showing you in a documentary style exactly what happened. Sometimes it's saying this thing happened, and then here's the story that evolves around from that moment.
Yeah. And you know, if I'm being honest, I think a lot of the omission of hockey action, and also just like general in between, because you know Check Please, that my comic, it tends to just go from like boom, sing the scene.
Yeah,
right.
A lot of that is I was trying to make the comic as fast as possible, because I guess I was telling it in like real time, and then I get very easily distracted. I just want to tell a story as fast as possible. So,
Well, it's really that actually leads me to a question that I had for you, because it's a really effective way of laying out the story. I mean, obviously, people can read it when the new book in stores now from Macmillan and First Second. But on checkpleasecomic.com, let's talk for a second about how you display the story, which is different a little bit than how a lot of webcomics do it. Do you want to describe for us the thought behind sort of going chapter by chapter or story scene by story scene?
Yeah, I would love to. And, well, I can first start off by talking about the weird format that the comic is in. It's not in this like 11x17 more traditional page format. It's in this kind of panel, like almost like you're watching TV. And the reason I did that was because when I was starting grad school, I really wanted to make sure that I had a good portfolio for storyboarding. So Check Please was my practice for that. It's all everything is TV based.
Well, that's a whole nother thing that we need to talk to you about is your MFA from SCAD, which is fascinating. So we'll swing back around on that too. Yes, but keep going. I'm sorry.
No, definitely. I always wanted to write for TV and like be a screenwriter for television. And I just thought of Check Please as these like episodes that I'd put out instead of releasing a few pages at a time. And, you know, now that I think about it, ever since I've been making comics, like as a teen, I always put out like complete scenes. I've never been able to just like put out a cliffhanger. I always wanted to like give an entire story in like a little chunk. So Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But what I find great about that is that, like, it's sort of with the authorial voice. You're like, no, this is the way to read this. And you have, if you're going to read it as this chunk.
Yeah.
Don't read it as a page. Don't read it as, you know, jumping around. This is the chunk you want to read. And there's something really satisfying about that. It took me a split second. I remember when I first got to the site ages ago, it took me a second to latch onto it. But once I did, I was like, oh, this is great. This is a very pleasant way to present a comic online.
It's almost similar to how Instagram does panel by panel in that once you use the standardized navigation buttons underneath, which are actually for chapters, you go up into the panel and then you see the little arrows appear on the left and the right, and you path back and forth through the panels, which is, I'm telling you, it's a fantastic way to read comics. I'm kind of surprised I don't see it more widely used.
Thank you for that. That was totally built by my friend Aaron, who just built my entire site. And the reason that even exists is because when I was first putting this up on Tumblr, you can only upload images in these 10 picture photo sets. And with the photo sets, you'd click through them. So it's kind of funny how you guys are, I really appreciate that praise for the comic, but it was totally an accident. It was because of Tumblr's functionality.
Just take the praise that we think you're a genius. Just take the praise.
Yeah, this is my genius idea. Yay.
These are great ideas, kid. You're really fantastic.
What can I say?
No, but it still, though, the fact that you have stuck with it and made it work so well, I mean, granted, sometimes necessity, you know, causes invention like this, but you've found a way to make it work really well. And I wanted to applaud you on that because it's a really cool way to read a comic. It's
so
a really
much.
Effective way to read a comic. But now let's jump back, actually, since you brought it up, Tumblr, because one of the things that I always found interesting about the way you would present the comic is that it kind of like Akewood used to do, you jumped around to different media to tell the story.
Oh my gosh. Yes. And that's also kind of like an accident. Like, of course, when I was making this comic, I never thought that it would be published. I just was making stuff. So like everything that, so there was a main comic and then I was writing these weird blog posts, which I still do, which I mean, like you can never fit into a book because there's too many of them. Then I would just draw these sketches and put them out there. And then the biggest part was I would tweet as my main character, Biddy. So there was no like grand plan for uniting all of these, and especially into a printable format. But in my head, I was just like, I have a lot of story I want to tell. Let me see. I just have to get it out. It is in any way I can, in any avenue.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you ever find that there's like when you get an idea for a certain event or a moment or a thought for, say, Biddy, like, do you ever have a struggle internally of like, do I put this in the blog? Do I put this in a tweet? Do I put this in a comic?
Oh, man, that's a very good question. Usually it's determined by if it's a comic, if something I'm going to put into a comic, it's usually I've written up the comic beforehand. So I'm not going to like add a fresh idea into the comic.
But
if it's like I have this idea of Biddy, like, responding to the fact that Beyonce just gave the world news that she's giving birth to twins, I'm like, okay, I immediately have to make this a like side comic that I'll put on Tumblr, and like it's very topical, it's very fun. But if I stopped tweeting as Biddy, but if it were a tweet, I'd probably draw a picture of Biddy like crying in a selfie, and that would be the tweet. And he'd be like, thank God for Beyonce's womb or something. Like, so yeah,
right.
There's so many ways to like, if I want to show a character reacting to something, like in that case, a piece of news, like I can make a little side comic about it. I can post Biddy like doing a tweet, or it could be referenced in the comic like a year later. So.
And a lot of that stuff probably will fade in with time, you know, like in terms of the immediacy is what makes it fun. But do you ever see, and maybe there's talks with Macmillan, like some huge collection down the line that would have all the blog posts, all tweets, all the...
I don't know. Like,
Or would that not be as special? Like it really only works when it's across different media platforms.
I'm not sure. I feel like there would definitely be some readers who would want that, who would want just everything in one place. But I've never been the type to, I shouldn't even be saying this, I've never been the type to value like something in its printed form too much. Like the things I'll buy in printed form are reference books, like, because it's easier to flip through. But, mm-hmm. and I think for some, like, having everything in a printed form would be like a reference book to them. But I don't know. I'm kind of like, just keep it online, keep it in its kind of random scattered format. It's fun discovering things as you stumble upon right. pages and links.
Well, this is kind of a fascinating attitude. I hope you don't mind a follow-up question.
No, let's
go. What does the book emotionally represent to you?
Oh, man. Oh, my goodness. What does it represent to me? Okay. So I would say that I've been self-publishing Check Please for some time. But it's so funny. Oh my gosh. When I first self-published Check Please, I think it was 2015, I was finishing up grad school. I wasn't even done with grad school. And I was working with a company that in turn was working with a company overseas in China to get everything printed. And I just remembered that that was extremely stressful, but when the book existed, I was still stressed, but it existed. It was missing a page, which like in my,
no,
oh my God,
that's the worst.
No, it's okay. It was like a page. Most people did not notice and it's totally fine now. But I mean, I designed the book from scratch. Like I have no idea how that happened. I think I went into like a fever state or something because
wow.
Yeah. And so, like having that in the physical form, I was just, it was weird. It was weird to see, and to see that people wanted to buy it was also very strange because the entire thing's online for free, which I've said in signings, I've said in panels, and I don't think McMillan for a second, they don't care.
I like that idea. You don't have to buy this. It's free.
I'm like shouted. Someone came up to like I was at a small press expo in Bethesda, Maryland, just like a month ago. And someone came up to my table and was like, yeah, we got the book in our library and there's 32 holds on it. And I was like, this is so dumb. I was very thankful, but I was like, that's absurd. Please just read it online. So having the self-published form kind of made it feel like that people cared about it because it was actual a physical thing that people would buy and then cherish. I think the biggest difference is seeing the book in bookstores and
right.
and knowing that it's not just in bookstores, but in libraries. I think that's the maybe the most like emotionally that's like, oh, this is part of something that could, this could be part of someone's like journey into comics. You know, this could be part of someone's self-discovery. People that, you know, aren't old enough to be like randomly online. And so I think that emotionally that's probably the most meaningful part of being published on this platform.
A library is so wonderful too, because you know that there's a kid out there that doesn't have the money to get a book, maybe
definitely.
Doesn't read online yet, but that story is going to impact them in such a perfect way, you know?
So that's like self-publishing could never get to that point. So it's really exciting. Yeah.
Well, do you mind if we brag on your behalf that I hope I'm still right about this,
sure.
that your self-published book on Kickstarter is still the highest grossing comic ever on Kickstarter?
It's the highest grossing web comics. So I can't say all of comics. I still think
you can't
like,
say all comics.
I still think like, I don't know who has that title, but for web comics, it's, I'm very thankful that I at least got that.
That's so exciting and amazing.
Yeah, it's really, yeah.
So here's the deal. So I'm and I'm going to ask the question that everybody who listens to this show wants me to ask, right? And part of it, I mean, number one, the reason that this Kickstarter went so well was because it starts out with a really good comic. The art is good. The writing is compelling. So you did a good comic. You put it out on Kickstarter. But this thing now is the most successfully funded webcomics Kickstarter. Did you use any strategies? Did you have an approach that you took that you think helped in this regard? Because that's what everybody wants me to ask. How do I do that too?
How do I do that? Yeah. I would say like, it's like a yes and no. It's something that, because if I were in a Hogwarts house, I would probably be in Slytherin. I can be very ambitious and analytical, but in no way, like when I did my first Kickstarter in 2015, I remember it was in Savannah, Georgia, because I was still in grad school. I remember the day before walking down to the river and just like looking at all the water, trying to calm my heart down. Cause I was like, if this doesn't succeed, I will have to become a TA, take another job. Like if this doesn't succeed, I cannot make comics for a living. Like,
yeah,
so there was a lot riding on it. But here's the thing. So I made sure I was like, I knew that I had a readership at that point and I knew that people were excited. But one thing that I didn't realize that I had done was kind of, let's say, prepare my readers or accustom them to purchasing things. And also letting them know, and also for myself, gauging interest. So
yeah.
So like the first, one of the things I did during another class that I took as a side project was I made this little zine that was a fan service sketch zine. And I put it online I made a pre-order. I did pre-orders online. And when I did that, I can't remember the number that came in, but it was just like 100 people were wanting to get this random zine that I was selling for like, I think $7 or something. I don't even remember. And that was like, the first time I realized that, oh wow, there's readership, but A, they're invested enough that they want to, own a part of Check Please in a way. And after I did that, like the Kickstarter was still very surprising, but, if I'm honest, it's like, oh, I could see that there was still potential for, because now it's not just a little zine, like, oh, there's potential for people who would like to get a book. And all Kickstarters are just glorified pre-orders in a way. So yeah, I would say if someone's doing a Kickstarter, testing the waters first is a really good way to see if you're in a good spot.
That's great advice. And you also, I don't know if it was in the most recent Kickstarter or maybe it was in the first one, but you also did a nice job of gamifying it, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I would say it was the most recent one.
Was that the most recent one? Okay.
So you're right. And it was definitely like, let's work together to see if we can hit these goals. I still feel a little like unsure about the kind of gamifying process because I think from here on out, I think Kickstarter, like I want my Kickstarters to be like very, just like straightforward. There are some readers who love like achievements and stretch goals and like all those extra little rewards, but the vast it's great to cater to that and to, you know, provide people with that extra engagement. But right. I also realize like for most people, they just want to put their money down and then get their stuff 7 months later. Yeah. So
I also appreciate though the drive towards more clear, like a simpler and more clarified campaign, because once you've reached a certain success level like you have with your Kickstarters, you can actually create a world of pain with a complicated Kickstarter.
Oh my gosh, yeah, you're right.
In terms of both fulfillment and running the campaign, I bet.
Yep. I mean, I have a manager, George Rohag. He's fantastic. He knows everything about the fulfillment process. He knows everybody in comics, like printing. I don't like because of his work with Oni and also with Homestuck. So he knows a lot. But at the same time, like, but by the time we do the year 4 Kickstarter, which we will be allowed to do, thanks McMillan, thanks for a second. It's going to be a situation of there's going to be 4 books. There's going to be like so many different combinations and so many different options. So I ideally want it to be just straightforward. Like, I don't know. So we're still thinking about that.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about that. The combination is like, I already have book 1 and 2, but I want 3 and 4. Well, I don't only
exactly.
have book 1, but I want 2, 3, 4. God, that didn't even occur to me. That's miserable.
So Pledge Manager is great for this point because we use a service called Pledge Manager, which allows people to select from any of the add-ons or any of the rewards. So they can make their own special combination that we don't have to deal with. But yeah, coming up with reward tiers, like I think we can't have more than 10. Like for me, like more than 10 is just like so many.
Yeah. Because there's a certain type of personality too, that if you give them a Denny's menu of options, they kind of shut down and they're like, I can't order.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's a really good point. It becomes overwhelming.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So,
So wait, did I hear right that you're going to be able to kickstart a fourth book while still being with Macmillan on?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Ain't that cool?
How is that working?
Okay. So let's see. How do I explain this? Well, it's not even being discreet. It's just saying like part of the deal that we approached like for second with was like so much.
By the way, if I asked a question that you can't legally answer without like
I'll just scream off the record. No, this is totally fine.
I know. I feel bad if I put you in a spot. You don't have to answer.
No, I will. I've. So basically the thing that we were able to bring to all the publishers that started to approach me and my manager after the year two, after the second Kickstarter, was if you're printing this book, you have to respect the audience that made the book big. Mm-hmm. And these are people who, you know, especially after the year two Kickstarter, they want the whole collection. And it would just be the epitome. It would be so bad to just not be able to continue that self-publishing process. And I mean, I do benefit from it being able to do a Kickstarter. But it's, you know, it's like, that's a portion of my income that like, it would be pretty bad if I wasn't able to continue to self-publish at conventions. It's merchandise that I can sell directly. It's like, it's a very custom item. And I think it feels, it still feels personal in a way that, getting the book in bookstores is slightly removed from that. So yeah. We were able to argue that with them. Like you gotta let us do this. So.
Well, wow. Kudos to you for doing that. That's fantastic to be able to have.
No kidding.
I mean, you can basically have your cake and eat it too, which is delightful.
A little bit.
I mean, you also still have the headache of a Kickstarter, but you have also the joy and excitement and the income of a Kickstarter, which is good. Okay, so I wanted to jump gears real quick and jump back to your MFA, which I promised I'd get back to. So tell me a little bit about SCAD. What first caught your eye about SCAD? What did you think about it while you were there? This is turning into 19 questions. So I'm going to start with what caught your eye about SCAD at first.
So so my undergrad was Yale, which is a great place to learn about a lot of things, but unfortunately not the best place to get a good draftsmanship background. Although their art program there is very analytical, very mm-hmm. process focused. And so I knew that I wanted to either go into animation or illustration or something in the arts, but I needed to improve my draftsmanship. So SCAD's sequential art program was a perfect fit. It's not a program where it's a program where you make pages, which is the only way to get better at comics. It's by mm-hmm. churning out like page after page with as little, I guess, pretense as possible. You're just making pages. So they throw you in, which is really wonderful. It's interesting because now I definitely have a interesting opinion on art school in general. I would say,
and what is that opinion?
Oh, here's my hot take. You're getting it from me. Right. I would say that for 95% of people, art school isn't necessary. And even for that last 5%, they could just go to community college. I'm a person that benefits from structure and I benefit from instruction. So mm-hmm. like SCAD worked for me, but the overwhelming majority of SCAD students don't work full time in the industry and even part time in the industry actually. So, mm-hmm. And I just mean in terms of like what their income from making comics is. So it's not an equal, It doesn't make sense. Also, and not to totally pull SCAD through the mud, but a little bit, like it's a school that really prides itself off of career and making sure that students have careers. But it's not, unfortunately, that it doesn't really translate as much. So when people in high school ask me about where they should go for undergrad, I really, really encourage people to go to liberal arts schools or state schools where they can get most of their education paid for, yeah, and take, yes, art schools on the, yeah, side. Because, oh, here's my last thing. Not only will they leave out of school with less loans, they'll have better job prospects. And most importantly, they will have studied something that is not art, which will help inform their storytelling. Like, there, mm-hmm, you go.
Right.
No, I happen to agree with that 110%.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right. And I've given the same advice. In other words, you definitely need a college education, particularly, mm-hmm, in the world that is evolving in front of us. This is something you're going to need, but you give the absolutely perfect advice. Go to a state school, and you don't have to necessarily study art.
Yeah.
Study something and then work on your art, because really the important part of comics is doing it and learning and being focused on what you're doing and getting feedback.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you 100%.
Well, it sounds to me like you, SCAD worked for you because as a member of House Slytherin, you were going to make it work, right?
I was definitely going to win the House Cup at the end of the year, so yeah. I just had to.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something to that. Like, you were going to succeed whether you did art school or not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, you were going to make those pages somehow in your life.
And I think it's that, like, it is the ambition of, like, since I was 14, I've been, like, putting my stuff online, and I've been figuring out weird ways to get paid for it. Like, I think I did my first round of commissions at the age of 15, like $7
for
a bus.
That's great.
But it was like, I set up a PayPal somehow. I think I had to ask my parents to make a bank account for me, but not,
wow,
so I can put like $7 in it from a stranger online. Wow. I didn't tell them anything, but yeah. So I'm glad it worked out for me, and it worked out for like one of my friends, Gail Galligan. She's a New York Times bestseller now. Mm-hmm. She works with Raina.
Nice.
She took over the babysitter's helm, but she's also a person who did undergrad at NYU. She would have been successful no matter where she'd gone. So I think she really got everything that she needed out of SCAD as well.
Well, the one other thing I want to jump back on that with in terms of putting out pages, because Brad always says, you know, you can't get worse at something that you do every day. And with comics, you were saying that SCAD.
That's such a good quote.
I know. I love it. It's so apt for comics, too. But yeah. But you were saying, you know, the big thing that SCAD did was it churned out pages for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If left to your own devices, how many pages or how many comics do you tend to produce in, like, say, a month?
Oh, that's such a hard question. Oh my gosh. Especially because like the average like page of Check Please now, there's more detail in it than the average page before.
Right.
Mm-hmm. A month? Man, I would say like, I would probably just say 20, but I also discovered that because I write, draw, color, and letter all of my work. But then I just do a lot of writing. I've discovered that, unfortunately, I am a writer. I write a lot. I outline a lot. I come up with other stories for things that may never become comics. So, and I draw a lot of illustrations and sketches. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of feeding that inspiration, what fun things are you reading right now? What's on your docket?
No. This is the question where I become embarrassed because of all the things I'm super passionate about.
Yeah, that's what we want to hear. We want to hear about your guilty pleasures.
Right, there we go.
Oh my God. But you guys have to, maybe you share stuff all the time, but you still have to tell me, so I don't feel bad. Okay, the best superhero comic being made right now is not being made in America. It's being made in Japan, and it's called My Hero Academia, also known as Boku no Hero Academia. It's by a mangaka named Hideo Horikoshi.
Okay.
And this guy is like in his 30s. He grew up not only reading like Naruto and Dragon Ball Z, but also Spider-Man, X-Men. And he, what like, I feel so passionately about this because what he has done with the superhero genre is A, made it pure again.
Really?
Because, yeah, these are stories that I could give to a 12 or 13 year old. Like, these are stories that are like younger than that. Like, and they focus on kids becoming superheroes. So the premise is in a slightly alternate universe, Japan. And we live in a world where people have these things called quirks, and you can develop your quirk by going to a superhero school, a very exclusive superhero school. Like Professor Xavier could not even run this, and you become a superhero through a lot of training, and it's actually regulated by the government. And it's such a uniquely Japanese take on the superhero genre, because American superhero comics tend to be more individualistic. It's about that personal revenge, where this is all about obligation and duty and regulation and getting licenses and going to school. And it's so fascinating. It's a totally different take. Yeah.
I love the idea of a Japanese superhero comic as well. Okay, fill out form 28B and then bring that back and get that stamp.
Actually, they have to get like so many licenses before these kids can like actually practice superheroing. It's so cool. It's funny.
There's something delightful about that, though. Storytelling.
Isn't it? And they're all freaking out because they're like, oh, I have to study for the oral portion of my license.
That's what made Shin Godzilla so good, though, when they revitalized the Godzilla franchise. Shin Godzilla was a standard Godzilla movie in that it didn't have the big CGIs. It was still a person in a rubber suit. But
yes.
The plot was about all of the bureaucracy that would happen if a monster attacked Tokyo. The real plot happened, again, off the ice, as we were saying.
Yeah.
It was all these bureaucracies that start having to talk to one another to actually do something like call for everybody to leave Tokyo. You know, what happens governmentally first? And it was an absolutely intriguing movie because every other Godzilla movie, everybody just runs. Well, this one is like, who's got to give the order to run?
That's so good.
It was absolutely beautiful. I loved every minute of it.
Well, that's why I never read it, but I always loved the concept of damage control in Marvel Comics.
Mm.
The
mm-hmm.
idea of like, here's the administration behind after the superheroes have beat up 19 buildings, who has to come in and clean that up. I just think the day-to-day view of what a superhero must have to go through is a fun idea. Okay, so that's a good one. What other good recommendations do you have for the world?
Can I give like book recommendations?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like book.
Please.
Okay, so you know the 2003 movie starring Russell Crowe called Master and Commander?
Yes.
Okay, so that was based off a 21 book series by a guy named Patrick O'Brien. I'm on book 7 of this series.
Oh my gosh.
Oh no, they've changed my life. it's terrible. My friend Brian Clevinger told me about them, mm-hmm. and like he did it in such a like casual way, like you might like these. And then I read the first book and I like texted him like a crazy person. He just did an evil laugh because he was like, yeah, you're going to read all of them now. So the premise of these books is and Patrick O'Brien, I think he died in like 2001. So I I'm not helping him sell any books, but
yeah.
The story is a naval captain who... the little captain named Jack Aubrey basically travels around the world with his BFF, a doctor named Stephen Maturin, who's also like a spy. And what makes it unique is the copious amounts of naval jargon, and like it's ridiculous. I would say it's 70% of the book. But you read that 70% so you can get to the sweet nuggets of male affection and friendship. And just like, it's so pure. It's so pure. And they like, they save each other. And there's like they shoot at each other, and there's broadsides, and like boats, entire boats will sink, and it's so much action and adventure. So,
well, I don't know the time period. Who are they fighting? Is it the Spanish or?
Oh, it's the French.
Oh, it's the French.
They hate the French. It's the 1800s.
Oh, it's the 1800s. Okay.
Yeah.
What I love about this conversation is doing this podcast, we've gotten a chance to talk to an awful lot of people who we respect as artists and creators. And there's one thing that I think all of them, as different as they all are, there's one thing they all have in common, and that is they get passionate when they talk about what they're reading.
Yeah.
You know?
It's so exciting.
It really is neat for me to see stuff like that where it's like, you know, this is something that you can tell you are absolutely lit up over is this.
Well, don't you think, though, as storytellers, we always respect when we find somebody that did it right, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And so you just, your brain starts firing on all pistons because you're like, oh, firing on all pistons, that's not right. But
I get you.
Because you're like, oh, this is the right way to structure this story. Oh, they did this character arc right. Oh, this is great. I'm learning as I'm reading.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, that's the most important part, is that it's like, oh, I see what he did there. I see how she did that, set up that scene. This is fantastic. I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, it's, oh my God. I mean, I'm not just stealing a lot of ideas from Patrick O'Brien. I basically was like, I'm going to take your characters, like scrub off the barcode and make my own little story that I'm not going to sell. I'm just going to do things with these characters. he's just so funny. For me, I always look for humor when people can get humor. Right. And like, this is like ostensibly one of the driest things, right? Historical naval fiction. Mm-hmm. I've like screamed with laughter, and all of my notes on my iPad are just me swearing at the characters and telling them to go to hell.
What's fascinating, though, is how did he spin it out into 21 volumes? How did,
oh, wow, what? There's so much to tell. How could you? He died on the 21st one. He didn't finish it, actually. He could have kept going.
Oh, he could have kept going. Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, man. If only he had. That would have been amazing. So.
Well, so now we know what you're doing for the next 4 years. All right. Well, this is good. So you're finishing up volumes 8 through 21, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
That actually brings me something that I jotted a note down. You said you were working on another comic, or you're working on a new project. Can you tell us about that?
Of course. Well, I finished writing a script for a softball story that my friend Madeline Rupert is illustrating. She's the creator of Sakana, which is a really fun, long-running webcomic.
Uh-huh.
She also played softball for 10 years of her life. And this story takes softball at an art school. And it's just propaganda. It's me saying, like, don't go to art school, but also make friends if you do go to art school. Make really meaningful friends. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So the sports seems to be a running theme.
Yeah, I could tell so many more sports stories. I'm shifting into superheroes because I've already spent way too much time developing a universe for that.
Mm-hmm.
But man, sports are so fun. I consume a lot of sports, so therefore my first reaction is always to make sports stories.
Sure, sure. But now we got to find the Venn diagram. Can we get what sporting events would they have played on a tall ship? Like, let's figure out how we can make your next story happen for you.
See, you asked that jokingly, and I'm like, oh, well.
I can hear her right now flipping through her notes. She's getting to the page.
There's a whole cricket scene. Yeah. Oh, no, it's the beginning of book 6. There's an amazing scene where they're playing cricket, and I was just like, it was like a gift to me. I'm like, I can't believe they're playing a sport.
So your world's colliding. You're like, this is everything I want in life.
Oh, it's so good.
I love that. Well, okay. Well, to round out the show, if you guys don't mind, there's some listener questions that I wanted to ask. And the first one is kind of interesting, especially given our topic. And here's the question. Are there any good books or sites on character development that you recommend, or is this just something you learned the more you wrote? So let's direct that one first to our guest. So Ngozi, are there any good books or sites on character development and character building that you recommend, or is this just something you learned the more you wrote?
I think it's something you learn the more you write, but like, I would say there's a book called Into the Woods by John York, and he gives the most concise and like analytical explanation of what makes a character interesting. Mm-hmm. It's not just about a character's fears. It's not just about characters' wants. It's how we as humans are consistently trying to hide insecurities and also trying, like, we want things and we purposely self-sabotage ourselves. Like, it's a really great book. Like, and it's crazy how true it is. It's just,
yeah, that's a great insight though. Yeah.
And no, but development, I guess, like, but I guess development is that self-awareness that comes through external forces, our internal examination, but you just got to write about characters experiencing things and reflecting on their decisions, I guess.
Yeah, I gotta say, I kind of agree with you, because I was looking at that question and I don't know that I would be able to direct somebody to a good book on that, like that right. deals specifically with that. And yeah. I think what that is that's because character development kind of wraps into an overarching idea of narrative, in that you want your characters to change through your story, and that change is going to be based on the story you're telling. Let's address that from a different angle. If I were to write a book on character development, what would chapter one be? Well, I don't know, you know, because there's so many different types of stories, so many different types of approaches to this. I think really I think you will become better at character development the more that you actually write your story with an idea towards, these people are not just sock puppets that talk. They are being changed by the story, and your ability to show that change is going to determine how well you're doing, not only storytelling, but character development.
Right.
I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I like both of you. I don't know that there is a single book or books that I could recommend for character. I mean, like, I know Stephen King and Mark Twain have some pretty good books on writing. And I think, was Neil Gaiman, I haven't read that one, but didn't he have one as well on writing?
I'm not sure.
Maybe not. Okay, the silence tells me that my brain invented that third one.
No, I would say, that's such an interesting question, though. It's almost, I always feel like it's not the right question.
For me, yeah, the go-to is, one of the things I always like to think of with a character is that, like Ngozi was saying, there's always that competing problem of insecurities and then the public face that we put on those insecurities, which mm-hmm. is super true. But then I also think that another thing that's helpful with characters, even villains, is that a part of their mind always believes that they are the hero. And that's true with so many characters, is that in their own internal struggles, they always like to think that ultimately they're a good person and are trying to do the right thing. And that's a helpful way to write at least conflict-based storylines, I think. And then the other thing that I have found helpful when I'm starting a story and I don't know who these people are yet, is a lot of characters, we reveal themselves or we reveal them through their reactions to events. And so sometimes it's helpful, if you're creating like a character Bible, to just have created fake events in their past that they reacted to. And that helps you as a writer at least start to suss out who they are, because those events, which will never be revealed in the story, you know, okay, well, in reaction to the divorce, they reacted like this, and that mm-hmm. lets me know a little bit about them. Or in reaction to this war, they reacted like this, and that lets me know a little bit about them. So sometimes in writing a character Bible, that's helpful in just giving a little backstory to where they were, that the audience will never see, so that you know better where they're going to go, maybe.
What do you do in Ngozi to keep yourself organized in terms of character? I mean, do you have a character Bible like David does? Do you have, I hear you writing notes as you're reading, I'm thinking that might be likely. What's your process when it comes to character?
It's so funny, like, I always say I'm an organized person. When it comes to storytelling, it's kind of a big old jumble. I made a wiki for my next universe, just because there were too many characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's this really cool program called TiddlyWiki. It's such a It was made by British people.
Say no more.
It allows you to connect and basically make your own wiki, and then you can export it. So I've been doing that, but Yeah. And actually, to go back to the question, I think maybe this person meant not like how a character, like maybe they weren't referring to character arcs, they were referring to making characters. I assume that, because then it makes more sense, right?
Well, let's put it to you this way. If that was the question, how would your answer change?
Yeah, it would still be the same, because talking about development is way too, it's like, how do you win at storytelling?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know what? Let me, for fun's sake, change this question around for both of you. How do the visuals of your character development impact the writing, or vice versa?
That's a good one.
How do the would you say, Dave? How do the visuals?
Well, I phrased that poorly, but like the look of a character: are they tall? Are they short? Are they wide? Do they have a massive mustache? Do they have weird spiky hair? Like how does that influence character development or character design in terms of writing? And how does the writing impact the character visual design?
Man, yeah, you could definitely. I can't answer. I have to think about that a little bit.
Okay, Brad, you want to take a stab at that one?
Well, I don't know that I'm going to be able to address that directly, but what I will say is that when I'm going through and writing my stories, I've got kind of a few words written next to each of the characters, and give me a few ideas and a remembrance of what their voice is like, you know, what their central attitude is, the best way to describe them in three words and stuff like that.
Right.
That's kind of been my touchstone for how these characters behave in different situations. I'm not sure. I mean, obviously in terms of look, there are certain things that come into play, and I don't know how much of this is right or not, but I've got a whole idea about noses. Like, like if I draw somebody with a long, sharp nose, I know exactly what that character is. And it's very different from somebody who might have a small, rounded nose.
That's great. That's exactly what I was shooting for, was how
do you know what I mean?
I love it.
And so when I'm drawing somebody and when I'm trying to nail down a new character, I find that I spend most of my time on their nose, because eyes can be a certain way and mouth and facial features, and certainly without a doubt, jawline. But when it comes down to it, for some reason, I keep fixating on the nose.
Wow.
Huh. That's fascinating. But that's exactly what I was shooting for. Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, I like the fun play of both drawing to type and drawing against type in terms of the villain or the baddie,
yeah,
or, you know, the hero. It's fun to, as visual artists, we can have a fun interplay of that really only casting agents get that kind of fun, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy that aspect of it. But Ngozi, before we move on from that one, any last thoughts on how you design for your writing and how you write for your design?
Yeah, I would say like my writing and drawing process is I do things in big strokes and then kind of improvise. So when it comes to coming up with characters, man, I'll come up with the characters look like a month before they appear in the comic, and which I know that some people have original characters that they had for years, they've had their OCs, but I'll look at a few actors that I feel like would work with the character. I'll do a few caricatures, and then from there, kind of boom, then I have a character. And also my character designs, they change so much over the course of a comic, so very flexible.
Talk about that for a minute,
no,
because there's a lot of people who are scared to let themselves do that.
Oh,
they think
fine.
That they're locked in, but I think people need to hear that, because I do that all the time. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, this character is I drew this character in February, I'm drawing this person completely different in October, and that's okay.
Because
I know who they are better than I did in February, right?
Yeah, yes. I don't know. I don't know why anybody would get hung up on that. Comics aren't anything rigid. It's okay to experiment and let things change.
It's kind of like coming to know the face of a person in real life in a relationship. You examine it more. You know it better. You know it differently. And so the same is true as you come to know a character. You're going to draw it differently as you come to know them better. I think it's perfectly natural.
Yep.
Well, Brad, why don't you finish this off? Do you want to read the last question we've got for today from a listener?
This is something that I really want to hear from you folks about, because I think it's a central problem that many artists have. This person writes, when completing projects, I love repeatable processes and to-do lists. I also have so many ideas that my backlog of projects to eventually do gets pretty overwhelming. Do you have any suggestions for apps or physical methods to keep it straight without a lot of self-creative administrative overhead? And we're going to defer to our guest, Ngozi. What are your thoughts? How do you stay organized?
Okay, if that's the question, then... It's really easy. Just get a manager. I'm just kidding. No, I'm totally 100% kidding. I've always been relatively organized ever since like middle school when they first gave us planners. I've always just loved like checking things off and crossing things.
Yes.
Yeah. And so me and my friends were actually having this conversation yesterday about what planners we're going to get for 2019. I use a passion planner, which is really fun. Definitely type that up. Type that down. It's really good because it also has like every month that puts a moment. You have to have a moment of reflection, which is really nice. I know that like Carrie Peach and I think Gail too. Carrie Peach just published a book, also a bestseller, The Adventure Zone with the McElroy's. Mm-hmm. And she uses Excel, I think, to keep track of all of her pages. But every day I have a little to-do list that I cross off. And then I also have a bigger to-do list in my planner as well. Yeah.
Wow. I'm looking at this passion planner, which I had never heard of online. I'm looking at it right now. That's a really cool thing.
Yep. I think this woman she's like in her 20s too, but she's like, I think she does things where every person who buys one, they give it to like a kid at school. She's amazing.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to have to check that out. Thank you for that one.
Well, Brad, how do you I was going to beat you to it. Dave, how do you stay organized?
So I do three things. The first one, on a day-to-day basis, when I'm doing the things that I have to get done today, I still find that a written out list that I get to physically scratch out as I get them done, I find that so satisfying. I like the tactileness of a piece of paper for the to-do list today. I find really much more than like a digital thing that I click and then that thing, you know, deletes out or lines out digitally. It's just not the same. So for the things that I'm taking action on today, I use a written list. But the two things that I recommend, Wunderlist is an incredible cloud-based app that's free. I think you just have to set up a Microsoft account. And Brad and I use it for this show. I use it with my assistant and I, Beth, here in the studio for long-term and short-term projects. I have whole separate sections for like things around the house that I need to get done. It's really helpful for capturing ideas that you might not get to for 6 months or stuff that you need to do later this week. And you can create a bunch of different categories. It's very easily trackable. It's very easy to recover something that you accidentally checked off as done. Wunderlist is great. So I recommend that. And then the third one is I'm very big on physical things in my studio that I can see. So I have a very big 30-inch by 20-inch wall calendar, you know, the big ones that they have kind of in an office setting.
Yes.
And then I have a very large, Brad's makes fun of me for it, a magnetic board that I have broken down by week and by month of all the things I need to get done. And I move the little magnets around. I have like little magnetic, like life game pieces that I put on whenever I get it done. So I don't know if you remember the game of life.
Of course.
Yeah. So they're like have little magnets on them. And whenever I get one done, like, did I do today's comic? Great. That one gets a magnet. Did I go to the gym today? No, probably not. So that one didn't get a magnet per person yet. But anyway, so those are the three ways I do it. A written list, a magnetic list, and then a wall calendar with, and then I guess four things, Wunderlist as well. So
nice.
That's probably too many things. But okay, Brad, now you go. How do you stay organized on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis?
I've got so many thoughts on this, especially because it just came up in our life. My older son is in high school, and he was having a little bit of trouble staying organized. Mm. And So we sat down. I said, okay, how are you trying to stay organized? What are you using? Well, I set reminders on my phone, and I'm like, yeah, that's the first problem, because you never do it in the moment. And then by the time you do it, you've forgotten to do it, or you haven't done it. And, you know, I am 100% against any digital method for personal organization. Oh. I don't like it. Ooh. Because I think Wunderlist for what we do, Dave, is fine. But I'd never use Wunderlist in my personal life. And I'll tell you why. Because you need that immediate, I need to write this down. You need that trigger in your head. And the act of writing that down, you can write something, you can make a note so much faster than you can get your iPhone out and turn it on and launch the app. And then now you got to put something into this app. And you're going tack, 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 tack. And then you've got to date it. And then you've got to decide what sound effect you want when it comes up and all this other bullshit. And listen, all that stuff is great, but it nothing. So you know what I did? I bought him a little 5x7 sized moleskin. Yeah. Little notebook. And I showed him how to make a to-do reference with a little box on the outside that you put a check mark in it if you're starting it, and you fill it in solid black when you're done. And I said, you are going to become obsessed with with filling in little black boxes when you're done with this stuff. And I said, I bought you a small one. It's 5x7. So every class you can easily put it in your pocket or in your backpack. And every class, when you sit down, the first thing you're going to do is put it in the upper left-hand corner of your desk. Every time, every place, and in the same place. I said, listen, part of this is getting a little bit OCD. Part of this is setting up routines. That little moleskin is going to be in the upper left-hand side of your desk every time, to the extent that if it's not there, you're going to go, what's missing from the left-hand side of my desk, right? And then write stuff down. So far, I got to say, uh-huh. So far, because I check him now, because he comes in the house, I'm like, show me your to-do list, you know? And it's also helps because he kind of started halfway through, and he also uses it. He's very interested in writing right now. He's very fascinated in writing stories, writing humor. He's very interested in. So it's like I told him, you can we'll put a little bookmark in there from the second half of the moleskin on. You can write story ideas. And you can write down things that occur to you. So that's another reason I want him to always have it in his grasp.
Aww.
But I'm telling you, everything that I've got right now in my studio, I'm sitting at my desk, everything is Post-its and little 5x7 index cards. And I've got everything laid out in front of me. And part of me is part of the reason that I want to get things done is so that I can get some of this clutter off my desk. Hmm. And that's an incentive for me. Okay, today at some point I got to call in and make a dentist appointment for my kid for his braces. This is something that I hate doing. I don't like talking to people on the phone. I hate talking to some dummy on the phone. And what time do you want to come? And what? Oh, my God, it's the worst. But I've got to do it so I can get this damn note off my desk because it's cluttering things up. You need that sense of the physical is what I'm saying. And that's why all these apps, to-do list, to do this on the app, none of that is good as just putting a note right there on your desk and having it with you.
So I feel like organization is actually it's a subset skill of professionalism, and it's really important in comics. And it's really, by the time someone wants to make comics, it's almost too hard to teach. Like, yeah. What do you do at that point if someone's like not put together?
Well, you know what? I think it's helpful at least to know that, like, if you want to make comics your pro-am or professional career, and if you're in your own life feeling like you're not very organized, this is something that's important and it's worth working for. It's kind of like for me right now, having let myself go for a bit, I've got to get back to the gym. It's not fun to think that I have to get back to the gym, but at the same time, I know that for better health, I've got to do it. And for better cartooning, you've got to organize, you've got to learn and teach yourself how to be better organized. Because all three of us know an artist that works in chaos, but frankly, the more you can make it easy, even if it's organize chaos, it's happier mm-hmm. and better work. And frankly, you will eventually burn out in a much quicker time if you don't have some form of organization, I think. Wouldn't you guys say?
Yeah.
Well, on that note, then, I don't want to hold up our wonderful guest much longer than to say thank you, Ngozi, for joining us. This was a delightful chat today. It was really, really nice
to
have you on.
This is so nice. You guys are so kind. Thank you so much.
Well, and if you don't have it physically on your bookshelf yet, you are at fault. You need to go to the store or go to Amazon or go to Barnes & Noble or go to Books A Million and get the new Check Please from Macmillan and First Second Books. Or if you want to check it out for free, as she will repeatedly tell you, that it's for free to read online, checkpleasecomic.com. Please go check it out right now.
Yeah, and it is well worth your time. Beautifully, beautifully written and wonderfully drawn. It is. It gets high marks all across the board.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And it is my great pleasure to tell you this. You've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com and Drive at drivecomic.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode, as all episodes, was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice, patreon.com/comiclab. Have you ever seen a rat that size?